Welcome to our special 10-year anniversary podcast series. I'm Stefan.
And I'm Paul.
And we're your hosts. We started Stories We Don't Tell with our good friend Brian Bennis back in 2014.
And from the beginning, we've been recording all the stories. So for this series, we went back through our archives and picked stories from 10 storytellers, one from each year.
And each episode, we'll chat with one of the tellers and hear a story from them.
On today's episode, we're talking with Veronica Antipolo.
And we are here today, joined by esteemed storyteller Veronica. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what's great about having you on this 10-part series is that you have, I think, experienced a wide range of different ways to be connected to Stories I Tell. You guest produced last year. You've obviously told many stories, and we'll hear one later on this event. But for those of our listeners who may not have come across your work before, can you give us a brief explanation as to who you are and how you find yourself here?
We know my name is Veronica. I started storytelling, I think, in 2018, and stand-up at the same time. I actually leaned into stand-up first. And then storytelling was sort of like this, sort of my extramarital affair. and then I decided actually during the pandemic that there was nothing about stand-up that it didn't have the depth that I wanted. I needed a range, and storytelling was where it was at for me. So I leaned all the way into storytelling, and I've been storytelling since 2018 now, and now I actually teach it. But for me, because of my personal experience, the perspective that I lean into is, what's the impact on the teller, the person who owns their narrative? And how does it spark change for whatever, social justice or just any kind of change in general, but not from the perspective like, what does the audience get out of it? Because everyone talks about that. It's more about how can you talk about sparking social change and what the audience gets out of it in engagement. We have to start with the person who's actually owning the story and telling the story. So that's what I ended up leaning all the way into. Actually, I didn't lean into it. I became obsessed is what happened.
We can relate.
Yeah. So it's sort of interesting, like all you're talking about stand up and then you're talking about getting into storytelling. So for you, like what getting to that point, what was it all those years ago? Whether it was getting involved in our event Stories We Don't Tell or your own experience with more personal storytelling, what was like that first story or that first, you know, on the more personal side that made you want to kind of, you know, push forward more with the personal storytelling?
I think so when I took storytelling, I took it at Second City, Storytelling 101. I skipped my grad show and I went to Stories of Ours, which is where I met you, Paul. And honestly, I was on the bus and I was gonna make up an excuse and not show up. And I showed up and I was very scared. Because culturally too, because I'm Filipino, my whole family's like, why? You don't tell anybody about anything. Like vulnerability is like, you just don't say anything. Everything's fine. And we're just irritable towards each other all the time. That's acceptable. So this was like a big thing for me. And I remember I was intimidated too by everyone's bios I admit this too. I feel like bios make everyone sound so great, but also removed from like the general population. So you think, they're this otherworldly person. And I remember sitting there and it was my turn. I was like, you know what? I'm just going to shut off and do my piece. And I knew then that simultaneous feeling of wanting to run away and be swallowed up, but also of like this like vomiting of like having to just finally let this go was just so extremely cathartic. And I knew when I went to go stand beside the homemade dumplings that were there, and people started to come up to me and tell me that they had found something in my story that they resonated with, even though like everyone's story, it can be vastly different. I knew that there, right there in that moment, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm not going to stop doing this. Like I knew it. And that was it. Like from the very first moment that I had an interaction with an audience and that connection point after.
I'd like to dive into that a little bit more because it's something that we actually haven't talked to folks about that much, is that experience of talking to the people afterwards, the experience of having someone come up to you and being like, oh, that resonated, or oh, that was so interesting, or the same thing happened to me, like, which is something that we've found time and time again. And it, for stories I just never possibly could have imagined would resonate to anyone else. You know, it's even, it seems, which, you know, like there's a mathematical, apparently, reality. And this is going to sound very unrelated, but I promise to come back somewhere. And apparently in a room of like 30 people, it's mathematically more likely that two people have the same birthday as not, which just doesn't make sense to me. And I haven't done the mathematical proof, but that is apparently true. And the same thing I feel like is true with storytelling. Like you can tell a story that seems totally off the wall or totally in your own, only you've experienced it. You know, like this is all mine, this is me. And then you will find someone more often than not in the audience who is like, oh, that piece that is so me, or oh, that thing. And it's, and it creates this moment of connection that is really, really special. So can you talk a little bit about like your experience? Yeah. Just talking to people afterwards, you know, like that, that vibe.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there's another storyteller, Georgette, who I think you spoke to, Georgette Stubbs. So we co-founded Housewarming. And then we changed it to Mosaic because everyone thought it was a literal housewarming. But we actually modeled a lot of it after Stories We Don't Tell, because the vibe of what Stories We Don't Tell is what we wanted to cultivate, was that feeling of connection and really having like this intimate, personal, it's like a kickstart. You don't find that in any other place except maybe group therapy. I don't know. So, that point of connection is something that we try to cultivate with ours and mimicking Stories We Don't Tell, because what we found, especially because the demographic we focused on were women of color, and both of us as women of color, like I said, culturally, it's like we don't talk about what's wrong. It's always very much about present as resilient, as strong as you can handle everything. So we had trouble getting storytellers the first time. We had to mine from our certain network of friends, coerce them, or not coerce them. We encouraged them aggressively. And what we noticed afterwards is that they were so, it was that same feeling that I went through. It's like, I definitely don't want to do this. And a few of them were like, I was going to quit just before the event. And we made it a point to say, please come and talk to the storytellers after. I think we got that from you. And I told them, I said, what you'll notice is that people will come and talk to you and you have such an impact on them. So you have to realize, put yourself in their shoes. If someone comes to talk to you, that's a big deal, because why would they come and talk to you if it was like a regular cocktail party? Mm. But for every person that comes talk to you, maybe it's five people, just know that there are five more people who won't say anything to you. They'll maybe they'll gaze at you from across the room for whatever reason, they're shy, whatever. But just know that your story, showing up just as you are without having to present a certain way, has such an impact on people, and you will never, ever know. And it's, I think we need like activists and people like that who are on the street and fighting or whatever and all that stuff. But like, there's something about storytelling that's so deeply impactful, and it really like stays with people, that it's like, okay, so it's five people, but if those five people, say two of them, decide to do storytelling or somehow like talk about it going forward to five people, I'm like, that's such a deep ripple effect than trying to speak to masses or trying to convince masses, regardless of like we're talking about social issues or just connecting in general. And I don't know, I really started to recognize the power of storytelling.
So it's interesting because the activism aspect has come up now a few times in dealing with it in different the content that is going on in these events and other people's stories. And I'm curious when you are then, so again, this is you're another person that sort of went, you've got experience as a storyteller, and then you've gone to facilitate with other people's stories. And how did you, what do you, and you were talking about earlier about a different, like the effect on storytellers themselves and all that kind of actual things that are physiology happening to somebody, or physically happening to somebody. What, so I'm just curious, like, how did things change for you or evolve going from, okay, I'm telling my own personal stories to then kind of facilitating events and dealing with other people's stories and trying to help them kind of, you know, bring them to an audience?
I don't know. I don't know because like I was just really beginning too, right? So even when we started with Mosaic Housewarming, we just did what like you as producers of a storytelling show did yourselves. It's like we workshopped the storytellers, but for whatever reason, I think from what I had learned or how I wrote my stories or the way I tell stories, apparently the way I edit or I help people edit became this thing where it became this cathartic thing for people. And so I don't know, it was just this weird organic thing that happened, and I just happened to share and people resonated with. And then actually I found out later, because I was having a conversation with a friend who is now a psychotherapist. She's like, oh, you're touching on narrative therapy. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And she said, well, you're helping people reframe their stories. And it was the use of, like, one specific example I use is like the grammar is when I tell people, I'm like, if you bring it into present tense, it makes it more engaging when you're telling a story. Although grammatically, if you're like writing for a book or a short story, it doesn't make sense. But in oral storytelling, it's more engaging. But when you put it into present tense and it's your story, what happens is, like, you're taking this story that, if we're going to be extreme, like say it's traumatic, and you put it in present tense, and now you get to, you're reliving it, but sort of from a safe vantage point now, because you've passed it. And so you're able to reframe the story. I sound like I know what I'm talking about, but this has taken so many years and shopping people to say what's happening here, because I didn't know what was happening. I didn't know what was happening with people, what I was observing, and with myself. I don't know. It was just something that happened organically. And then I just didn't stop, because eventually I started making money off of it. Because of the people I was working with, which were mostly women of color, it turned out that people basically equated me with equity, diversity, and inclusion. And so I started getting work as an EDI consultant. So it became this thing. So then I started speaking at some universities and stuff on the topic of owning your story, but from an EDI lens. I guess because it's also the way people approach EDI, because EDI is so touchy now. It's a very structured, because you have to be able to explain things in a structured way for people to understand, break it down. But I think with storytelling, and the core of it is what you find is everyone is at the same at emotions. So when you take EDI and frame it within that lens, it becomes this digestible thing where people aren't thinking, oh, I have to do this, I have to say it this way, I have to use these terms. It's like you're just hearing from the human themselves and you're relating that way.
Yeah. I mean, I personally have experienced similarly the power that is taking reframing one's own story. You know, like there were stories in my head that or narratives that I had created about experiences in my life that I sort of would beat myself up on, you know, and I would go back to I'd review them on my brain. I'd beat myself up about it. And then when I would challenge myself to put it into a story to then bring to an event, and part of that, I would find myself, once I was completed that process, more often than not able to sort of walk away from it. You know, I was able to be like, okay, that happened to me, but here is my sense making of that moment. And I am now able to sort of leave it in this new way that I can move on from. And there is there's a complete power to that shift that you can find. And it's, yeah. And again, it's not, we were talking with another person about the difference. I think it was Brianne maybe in the first episode, the difference between sort of therapy and storytelling work. And one of the big changes difference between what we try to do is, like, we're not trying to get you to like dive deeper into your own mental neural pathways. We're giving you space to tell us now what it means to you. And we're not going to question. Yes. Like, you can just tell us what happened to you, however you want to frame it. And we're just going to accept it. Like, we're not going to go back and be like, but did it really happen that way? Or like, or what about this fact? That seemed weird. Like, a thing we talk about often is the difference between factual and true, because like in 7 minute to 10 minute storytelling, it's not often helpful to have, you know, six conversations with six different people when that could just be, you could just tell us it's one person. We don't care. Like, we don't, like, you don't need to get bogged down in those kind of unnecessary factual details, as long as the piece of it, the core, is true. But I think that freedom to identify it your own way, you're the only expert in the room, right? Like, you're showing up. This is my experience. This is my life. No one in the room is going to question it, because I'm the expert on my story. Is a shift that people don't experience that often. I think part of that value, it, you know, it helps you retrain your brain.
Absolutely. Yeah. You said something about being the expert basically of your own story. And I think that's, I had never experienced anything like that before at that point, like my 45 years of life or 46, I don't remember. Which is significant to say like in all that time, in being my mid 40s, I had never felt like I was an expert in anything. So to say, to even in my own life. So it's significant. That's a significant thing for many people, if not many people, marginalized, racialized people, like, to say you're an expert in your own life, because I don't know how many times I was told I wasn't an expert, not in words, but obviously through action. So yeah, I think that's such a, like, I know now that this obsession is definitely never going to leave, and I'm going to stick with it. And sometimes I go, why am I doing this? But I'm comfortable now knowing that this addiction is here to stay.
Where does this, what's your process in, like, how this, like, you bring us to, like, when you're telling a story, like, how do you approach it yourself? And what have you, like, taking us through this whole getting there, telling it, writing it, and all of that, that process?
First, let me preface by saying I don't recommend my method.
Right.
Because I am a master procrastinator. But also, I will say that I am ADHD, not self-diagnosed, but actually diagnosed in 2009. So my process, which I don't recommend, is I ruminate for many weeks, because I usually know many weeks before when I'm doing something. And then the week before, I don't even know if she's telling you, because since I have been on this.
No one, anyways, no one do this. No one else.
Okay, I should just lie. But actually, this is part of the process, because I can't just write. Like, I just don't know what I'm gonna talk about, because it is true personal stories. So I end up ruminating, and then everything becomes, it's interesting, because in the weeks prior to the week I start writing it, everything I experience in my life becomes a point of nostalgia or rumination or this introspection.
Mm.
And I'm like, am I doing what I'm supposed to, or am I wasting time? But I realize now, I'm like, no, this happens every time. It's part of the process. And then as the days, the time gets shorter as it leads up to the event, then I panic. It's always the same. And I think, oh, I have to write something because Paul or Stefan has just messaged me. And I better get to writing. And so I sit there, and actually that boundary oddly gives me the space to start something. And so I literally just, I like look at, sometimes I'll do a prompt, but it's not very structured. I literally just will like go through an old photo album or something, or look at some, I don't know, some real journal entry I had or something. And I just start there, and then I get carried away and I write too much. And then I bring myself back because I feel like I've had to vomit that up first. And then I always have to say, okay, just start with a moment. And I literally start with a moment that is part of what I want to tell. And then I expand it little by little, whether it's just expanding that moment into the location, the time, the age I was, starting to describe like the where I am or what's going on. And then I just, it's like a, it's just a movie reel in my mind, and I just start that way. If I write it, I'm able to just do what they say when you write is just write everything and don't edit. If I type it though, I am very prone to going back, backspacing and editing as I write. So I do a combination of both. The story of my grandmother, I wrote. And then when I started typing it, I had it in a different order. So I do a combination of both because I need the vomit, but I also need the structure. I need the mop basically to get it cleaned up. But both are necessary, but I try not to worry about the entire story as it's being written. Does that make sense? Like I'm just trying to sort of go back in my DeLorean time machine and try and remember it as best as I can to describe it literally moment by moment. Because I find sometimes there's first-time storytellers who get carried away with trying to tell this entire story within their entire lifetime. And I always try and say like, no, it's a moment. I mean, there might be a couple moments that span over time, but like they're moments, they're tiny little moments expanded. Yeah. That's my process. And then one of you will email me again. And I always say, yeah, I'll get it to you tomorrow. And I'm like, till 3 a.m. just writing.
Yeah.
I don't recommend.
Yeah. Not recommended, but real. And everyone's process is different. It works for you. There you go. I think that's everyone's got different ways of getting the questions, getting the things. So you referenced there your story with the grandmother. So we are going to go to that story. We are going to hear Veronica's story told a couple years ago, I think originally.
I don't remember.
Well.
It was before the pandemic.
Right. All right. We'll say 2019 just for fun.
Yeah.
Could have been 2018. But yeah. That's when you started. So it's one of those 2 years for sure. okay. Well, past Veronica, take it away.
Happy birthday, Aiden. I type into WhatsApp. It's September 17th, my friend Chandy's son's birthday. I feel like an asshole for not remembering most of my other friends' kids' birthdays. But I always remember Aiden's because it's Nanai's birthday too. Nanai, it means mom in Tagalog. But biologically, she's my paternal grandmother.
I'm 11 years old, and I go to a school beside Edwards Gardens, which, if you cut right through, goes right to Bridal Path. And in my class, a few kids live on the Bridal Path, like Mary Ellen, who spells it L-N. Mary Ellen's mom picks her up in a white Jaguar from school sometimes. And everyone else lives on a not as rich street, but they still wear root sweatshirts with their stirrups and Basswegians penny loafers. I have stirrups too, from Byway. And my root sweatshirt that I beg for at Christmas is 1984, even though it's 1985. And Fafa, my grandfather, sometimes picks me up in a red rusty car that has duct tape holding the passenger door together. And you have to climb in through the window to get in. And I can hear the car before it gets into the school lot. As a matter of fact, everyone can hear it. Just like any other day, I come home from school. And as I approach the low-rise building we live in, I know it's just Nanai in our apartment, in our third floor apartment. Because I can hear Victor and Nikki Newman in our third floor apartment all the way from the sidewalk. I get into our apartment and I wait to watch Little House on the Prairie. And I sit on the floor because my aunt, Tita Loida, says I'm not clean enough for the couch. I love Little House on the Prairie and the Ingalls family. They're white, and there's Pa, and there's Ma, and Mary, and Carrie. And of course, there's Laura, my favorite, with her braids and her slightly buck teeth. I live with Nanai, Fafa, and Tita Loida in a one-bedroom apartment where I sleep on the floor on top of layers of a benig, which is a woven mat, and a blue itchy blanket, and then a red comforter on top for softness. Nanai is making dinner. She likes to watch Little House on the Prairie with me sometimes, because it's her favorite too, after Young and the wrestling. But now she's in the kitchen chopping something loudly, over and over, blam, blam. And it sounds violent. It's bothering me because I can't hear the TV, which is already super loud at 52, so now I can hear the Ingalls from the kitchen. It's ruining my prairie vibe. It's the episode where Pa breaks his ribs falling off the roof. He's always breaking his ribs, Pa. And just as Doc Baker is taping Pa up, the falling leaves outside my window. Nanai! I can't hear. Stop singing. Her voice is too loud. And she doesn't have a beautiful songbird voice. She's in her late 60s and her voice sounds like a crackly old lady singing voice, but bolder and confident. And she's passionately serenading the meat she's bludgeoning. But it amuses her that I'm irritated. So even louder, with the cleaver now as her mic, the autumn leaves of red and gold. So I decide to go watch her make dinner because I'm hungry and I can't hear anyways. Nanai goes into full performance now with her made-up song. The falling leaves outside my window. The falling leaves of red and gold. She wants me to laugh or say something, and I just stare. See, this is why I don't ask Karen McKenzie or Melanie Michaels over. She smiles at me. What is the matter? I shrug, unamused. What's the point, I think? So I go back into the living room. I hate missing any part of Little House, but I feel like she's gonna do it again. So I listen just for a second. Okay, good, nothing. The falling leaves outside my window. Really? Nanai? Nanai's strange looking to me, but she acts like the beautiful ladies I see on TV. She has a scar over her upper lip, and it reminds me of a bunny. Her hair is thin and frizzy because of a bad berm. She is in her home clothes and her chinelas, but she's got on red lipstick. She always has on red lipstick that she's shoplifted. When we go out, she wears a fancy black hat, and out can mean the grocery store or a party. It's the same thing to her. And she carries multiple heavy bags of groceries home by herself. She doesn't even act like a grandmother. She's always telling jokes and makes fun of people in Tagalog right in front of them. And I warn her, Nanai, they can tell that they're making fun of them. No, they don't. The twinkle in her eye tells me she doesn't care either way. When she watches wrestling after church on Sunday, she jumps up and she swears at the TV, Putragis, get up! And when I have sipon and runny nose, she makes me blow my nose into her hand. Nanai seems so foreign compared to the usual recipe of what a lady should be. She's a comfort food stew compared to the amuse-bouche of females I see, especially in my school's neighborhood. The year I turn 12, I move in with my mom and my stepdad, and I finally have my own room with my own TV, and I can't wait to invite friends over to drink iced tea and eat chips. I can sleep on a bed by myself. And I'm so excited that I'm not even sad when I'm leaving Nanai, because I'll visit. She'll be here chopping, singing, watching Little House on the Prairie without me. She said so herself just before I left. This will be better for you. I was about 30 when Nanai died. I went into work as usual, sat down at my desk with my sunglasses on, and started crying. She wasn't always going to be there with her red lipstick chopping and singing. I never ended up visiting her as often as I always said I would, because I thought I was too different from her now. So different from that time, it feels like I'm making up my childhood with her. In high school, she and Fafa moved back permanently to the Philippines. And it was just before they moved that I figured out that what she was singing was real, not a weird made-up song that I was embarrassed by. A real song called Autumn Leaves. Nat King Cole sang it in 1945 when my nanay was Gorgunya Celia Antipolo and 33 years old. It's about remembering lost love. Now, I hear different versions of this song, sometimes in movies and anywhere really, but they all sound exactly the same to me. The falling leaves outside my window. Thank you.
We want to thank the storytellers for sharing these intimate pieces of their lives, the event hosts who welcome us into their homes, and the audiences who come to our shows and listen to this podcast. Music was composed by Arlene Pakulin. And for more information on the podcast, the book, event, or to join our mailing list, please visit storieswedonttell.org.